if you pay a buck for someone like Rourke, you have to use him or cut him. And that's what's tough. It's like, do you want to pay like two or three for Rourke? And Rourke's not going to go for a buck. He's going to probably go for like, you know, five or six. So do you want to pay five or six for someone that you have to ride or die with? I don't.
Hello and welcome to episode 179 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy baseball podcast. I'm Zach Steinhorn, the fantasy editor at Baseball Prospectus, joined as always by BP's senior fantasy writer Mike Gianella. And behind the figurative glass, we got Jen MacRamos, our producer and member of the BP stats team. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right, Zach. We've been lamenting how there isn't much to talk about. And as I talked to you on Thursday, December 20th, Manny Machado was in Philadelphia about 25 to 30 miles from where I live. And, you know, he and Harper haven't signed, but there's a lot of movement and there's a lot of action. And yeah, we've got a big podcasts, we should probably just dive right in.
Yeah, the Machado race is probably going to come down to the Phillies and Yankees, you would think, but we'll stay tuned for that. Probably we'll get some kind of resolution in the next week or so. But until then, we have plenty to talk about today. And before we begin, actually, just a reminder that you can rate, review, and subscribe to Flags Fly Forever on iTunes and Stitcher. So give us a good rating. It means a lot. So, all right. So now let's begin with there were a bunch of trades and also a bunch of free agent signings. So let's start with the trades. And the first trade we're going to look at is that wild three-team deal between Cleveland, Seattle, and Tampa Bay, where the Indians traded Edwin Encarnacion to the Mariners. The Mariners traded Carlos Santana to the Indians. The Rays traded Jake Bowers to the Indians. And the Indians traded Yandy Diaz and Cole Sulcer to the Rays. Okay, that's a lot to digest. But we've discussed both Encarnacion and Santana in recent podcasts, so there isn't a whole lot to add about those guys. The move to Seattle, you know, can't be considered a good thing for Encarnacion, but at the same time, he's also a guy who really has anywhere power. So, I mean, if anything, I think this actually makes him more attractive as a possible bargain option, because owners are going to be a little bit, they're going to discount the home ballpark switch a little bit too much. But then again, there's also talk that Encarnacion, you know, he could be headed to Tampa Bay. So we'll have to wait and see about that. And as for Santana, you know, he returns to Cleveland, where he put together several strong seasons. Most notably, actually, 2016 was when he had 34 homers. But anyway, Mike, so how do you view these two guys from a fantasy perspective? And, you know, does the trade have a significant impact on your valuation of them for 2019, or does it really not make much of a difference?
It's a blip on the radar for both. And, I think you kind of hit on it with Encarnacion, which is he's my thing about him. He's declined a little bit every year, like very steadily. Like, he's still been solid, but you really don't want to like overpay. And I think you want to kind of dial it back. He's been a bit of a batting average liability. He doesn't run, so he's a three category player. Santana's the person I'm intrigued by. He was clearly out of place in Philadelphia. It didn't feel like a good fit here. The return to Cleveland could energize him a little bit and make him slightly better. But yeah, on the whole, it doesn't move them either one very much. I probably have them ranked about the same. You know, they are what they are.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It doesn't really move, you know, the needle one way or the other in terms of at least mixed league valuation of them. Moving on to Bowers, it's not totally clear at what position he'll play. He could play both first base and the outfield, but I think the likeliest scenario is that he just rotates between first base and DH with Santana. So, Bowers, he was very inconsistent last year in his rookie season. He had a solid beginning, but then really struggled in the second half. He batted just 167 after the All-Star break with a 588 OPS. So thoughts on Bowers? Is he someone you'll be interested in drafting, say, in AL-only leagues or even in some deeper mixed formats?
Yeah, deeper mix toward the back end or on reserve is where I might take Bowers. He's probably a true sleeper. And, you know, he's a sleeper in part because, as you pointed out, Zach, he stumbled down the stretch. Perception's so funny. If it had been the other way and he had come, start out slow and finished like super hot, people might be, all into him. What really intrigues me about Bowers is the speed. He's certainly not a big time player, but he stole 20 bases in the minors in 2017, a combined 16 professionally last year. That's actually what the Steamer projection has him for. It's not great, but when you factor with everything else, it really kind of pumps up his value and is what makes me a little more interested than I'd be if he was just like a projected, 230, 240 hitter who was going to hit 20 home runs with no steals.
Yeah, the fact that we saw some, glimpses of, strong offensive production from him, makes me, slightly optimistic about what we're going to see from him next year. He did strike out quite a bit with the Rays, but his minor league strikeout numbers are fine. So, I think he definitely has the potential to, at his height, be, a 20 homer guy with, solid batting average and a strong OBP because his walk rates have always been pretty good.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I'd say is that, in a league like Tout that uses OBP, absolutely, he's solid. You probably want to be a little bit careful in an average league like Labor because, if he gets on base 32% of the time, Cleveland will play him. If he hits 210, that's really going to hurt your average, obviously.
Right. And my mind, as I mentioned before, is really skewed to OBP leagues for some reason. So, yeah, I always think of it through that lens. But, yeah, Bowers, I think, is a guy who, definitely someone who you're going to want to have on your radar, especially in mono leagues, but even in deeper in mixed auction Tout, he'll be someone who I'd be, depending on what happens in spring training with the playing time situation, he's someone I'd be willing to throw a buck or two at, at the end of the
year. I agree.
So, and then finally, just Diaz was actually the key piece going to the Rays. His defense at third base is considered subpar, so he might end up being a DH, but he did bat 312 in limited action for Cleveland last season. So what are your expectations for him for 2019 and beyond?
Well, my big thing with Yandy Diaz is where's he going to play? Like, I look at the Rays, and I don't know how he's going to carve out a full season. He's also the kind of player who I'm intrigued by him in real life. In fantasy, I don't see the power. I don't really see the speed. I think he's kind of like Matt Duffy without nearly like even that little speed boost. So kind of an AL-only guy. In deep mix, if you're using him, he's an injury replacement. The funny about Yandy is he's strong. Like, if you look at him and you've watched him, if you've ever seen him, he's muscular, like he's ripped, but the power, he's just not a power hitter. It's just not how his swing is. That's not how he's set up. Can the Rays change that? I mean, they could. It's just not something I'd bet on.
Do you think he falls more into that mold of, like you mentioned, like JP Crawford, like better real life player than fantasy player?
Yeah, I think so. What's intriguing is, as much as I say, where will he play? The Rays strike me as the kind of team that will give him a chance. Like, I can't envision them just bringing him in to send him to AAA. He's also 27, so he's not a young, like, even though he hasn't really had a shot, he's not really a young, prospect. He did come over from, he's also not like a traditional prospect where he was drafted. I think I like him as a player. The Crawford comp is pretty good. The one thing about Crawford is Crawford could run. He has a speed, but doesn't translate. Diaz, again, unless you're an OBP, OBP, I'm looking at the Steamer, it's like a 363 on base percentage. Average, it's like it's an empty 270. That's pretty much an AL only player, regardless of how many plate appearances he gets.
All right, so we'll be the Rays usually do pretty well with these prospect trades. So we'll see how quickly Diaz develops into a productive player in real life and even a productive player in fantasy. So let's now move on to the White Sox. Yonder Alonso was traded to the White Sox, and the Indians, they really had to find a taker for Alonso after bringing back Carlos Santana. And Alonso is likely going to play first base some in Chicago, with Abreu, shifting to DH, because Alonso is considered a better defender than Abreu. But, let's not overlook Alonso from an offensive standpoint. You know, he's really, over the last two seasons, he's really picked up the power. He has 90 career home runs, and 51 of those 90 home runs were hit over the last two seasons. So that goes to show just how all of a sudden he's become a legitimate power hitter after his early big league career of being just sort of a decent batting average, little power first baseman, which is really, not very useful in fantasy, especially in mixed leagues. So are you buying into Alonso as a legit 20 plus homer guy going forward, or do you think his power numbers are going to regress?
No, that's about right. His numbers did drop a little last year. He had 53 more plate appearances, 5 fewer home runs, so he slipped a little. But yeah, I can buy 20 to 25 home runs, especially in on the south side. That's a good park. Kind of the opposite. We're talking about Diaz. Alonso doesn't move the needle for me in real life. Not that exciting, but I can see getting 20 home runs and 250. And as we get into it in 2019, if you look at first base, used to be a guy like Alonso be back end in a mixed league, even a deep mixed league, kind of boring. Corner has really gotten weaker. I think you're going to be surprised when you rank your corners or CR rankings. Alonso's probably more of a mid-tier or, middle of the pack, or maybe bottom of that middle of the pack, as opposed to a bad first baseman. And Zach, you probably remember that. It used to be a 20 home run first baseman with a 250 average. You'd kind of look at it and go, that's okay, but it's not really something that hopefully I have on my team.
Yeah, the fact that he's done it though now for two straight years makes me feel a little better about, projecting him for next year. If it was just a 1 year thing where all of a sudden he goes from, 7 homers to 28 homers, and that's one thing, but I like seeing that consecutive year, 20 plus homer season. So I think Alonso, as a corner infielder, I would be totally fine with him as a corner infielder in a deep mixed league, like say Towers mixed auction. So, So if Alonso is my corner infielder, he's not someone to get overly excited about. And I remember actually I was in an NL only league years ago, and it was almost like, oh, you had Alonso, he's going to give you, 8 home runs, and it was just really boring, but you got the playing time. Now he's actually doing something with those at bats. So that's pretty exciting to see.
The other thing about Alonso too is, it's early ADP, grain of salt, but he's 28th first baseman overall. He's barely going inside the top 300. To me, I'm looking at some of these other names, that's a bargain. That's a solid get there.
Yeah. So let's keep an eye on Alonso in mock drafts and see if maybe his value will creep up a little bit. At least now that he's with the White Sox, a more favorable hitter's park than he was with Cleveland. So let's now go on to the final trade that we're going to talk about, and that's the deal that sent Tanner Roark to the Reds. Now, Roark is coming off two straight so-so seasons after enjoying a career year in 2016. His walk rate was good last year, a 2.5 walk to 9, but he was just a little too hittable and too home run prone. So now he moves to Great American Ballpark. So the home run rate spike is quite concerning, considering his new home ballpark. So to you, is Roark a viable back end rotation mixed league option for you? Is he more of an NL only guy, or is he someone that you're not even going to really be looking to draft this season?
He's a streamer in mixed. He's somebody I in a deep mixed league, I'd play the matchups. It's still the NL. There'll still be some softer opponents, but yeah, that 1 year looked like more, not even a fluke, but it just wasn't in line with his numbers. And you look at Roark's FIP, you look at his DRA, and that year just screams fluke. So I think Roark could put up an ERA in the low fours, but the strikeouts aren't there, and to me, that's key. And in today's game, you want a pitcher who strikes out about a batter every inning. He's not going to do that. And then you would expect, the Reds are making some noise about signing players, but you'd also expect the wins to drop. So, yeah, he's a streamer mixed and pretty much an NL only.
Yeah, there's not too much to be excited about with Roark. I'm not too interested in him in general, and he's definitely not a mixed league option for me. And drafting him in an NL only league, you were talking about that, I think, with Jay Bruce the last time. You know, drafting him in an NL only league means you're relying on him to be, you know, pretty much an every week starter for you.
Well,
so is that something that you're comfortable with doing? And to me,
So in a league like, you know, just as from a strategic standpoint, and Zach, you remember some labor last year, you know, so labor, if you pay a buck for someone like Rourke, you have to use him or cut him. And that's what's tough. It's like, do you want to pay like two or three for Rourke? And Rourke's not going to go for a buck. He's going to probably go for like, you know, five or six. So do you want to pay five or six for someone that you have to ride or die with? I don't. Whereas in tout, you can kind of, you know, you can reserve pitchers. You have that flexibility. I don't mind having someone like Rourke where I can, you know, use him in a road start, use him against a second division team, maybe use him at PNC, maybe use him against the Marlins. Like that would kind of be my play with Rourke. And, you know, it's tough in tout because in the onlys, there's only a four player reserve. So even then, he might not be like a top choice for that.
Yeah. And even in leagues where they do allow you to, you know, bench players and star players freely, you know, it's a guy that you're going to have to devote, say, $5-6 to him that maybe you could spend elsewhere. So do you really want to do that? Or would you rather just maybe take a chance on a younger guy for a dollar or two and, you know, use those extra funds to maybe address your hitting?
My strategy in tout last year with those players, they were all like one or two, and they were one or two for that reason. So I was like, you know what, if I'm going to stream nearly all these pitchers, you know, you hope one works out and they're not a streamer, but and I know last year was Yuli Chacin for me in tout, but it's like otherwise it's like, well, if these pitchers aren't going to work out, I'm going to stream them, then I'm not going to pay five or six out. You're right, when I can pay one or two.
Yeah, that's the route I would take. I'd be very hesitant to go those extra few bucks on Tanner Rourke. So let's now move on to free agent signings. And there were plenty of free agent signings over the last week or two. And the first one we'll talk about is the Phillies signing Andrew McCutchen to a 3-year, $50 million contract. The contract included a club option for 2022. And, you know, while McCutchen, he's no longer the first round five category guy that he was a few years ago, but, you know, he's still a very productive player. You know, 20 homers, 83 runs, 14 steals in 155 games last season. Batted only .255, but his OBP was .368. So, you know, he's definitely more appealing in OBP leagues. But even in batting average leagues, you know, I think he's a guy who might end up costing a little less than he should in drafts this spring. What's your take on McCutchen for this year?
I think he'll be solid. I see a season closer to 2017 with more power than 2018. It's just really a great park move. So, you know, last year in San Francisco, you know, he obviously didn't choose to go there. It was a trade, but and that park, almost every power hitter or anybody with any kind of power, it just knocks them out. A lot of balls go in that outfield to die, or, you know, some of them come hits, but it's just not a place that's conducive for home runs. You know, you even kind of saw it when he went to the Yankees. You know, he had five home runs in 114 plate appearances and was more of a power hitter. You know, the one thing I do worry about a little bit with Kutch, well, it's a couple things. One is the average. The days of him hitting over 300 are clearly over. So if he's a 270 hitter, that's solid, but, you know, don't look at the park and assume he's going to hit, you know, 300. Like, that's gone. The other piece of it is he did stop running with the Yankees. I know it's a small sample, but he's kind of reaching that age at his point in his career where I'd bet on him stealing like 5 to 10 as opposed to 15. Steamer has him for 11. I think that's fair. I just wouldn't count on those bags. Like, players reach an age and a point in their careers, you know, he'll be 32 or he is 32. That's the age he'll play at. That's kind of what I'm thinking. So, yeah, still solid, like still someone I'd want on my team, like probably, you know, second or third outfielder, depending on how I slot people in a deep mixed league, probably third. But yeah, not the core player that he once was.
Yeah, I view him the same way. He's sort of a, you know, low end outfielder too, high end third outfielder in a deeper mixed league. But I think, you know, I especially like him as, say, like a second outfielder in an NL only, because, you know, I think there's the combination of that, the shallower player pool and also the value he offers, you know, as many owners will be sort of paying a little too much attention to the decline as opposed to the player he still is. So I think, you know, in non-mixed leagues especially, he's someone who I think will be you could probably get for a little bit of a discount. considering the other options that are available.
So one thing that's interesting about this, though, and I do kind of wonder, so if the Phillies do sign one of Bryce Harper or Manny Machado, I feel like the opposite could happen. You could have a tax where people look at the Phillies, they look at the lineup, they get excited, and they stretch a little bit, thinking that, you know, oh, the Phillies are going to contend, or, you know, they made the big splash. You know, we all think that doesn't happen, but I think we know from experience that even in the expert league, sometimes people tend to fall into these, you know, these narratives. So that'd be the other side of it. If the Phillies do get Harper or Machado, I could see Kutch and almost everyone on the Phillies being overpaid.
Yeah, that's very possible too. You know, we'll see what happens with the free agent situation. But yeah, always on those drafts, even in expert leagues, you know, they tend to overreact to, you know, all the hot stove news and all the roster changes when maybe they shouldn't react that much. So we'll see. McCutcheon will be an interesting guy to look at from, you know, a value standpoint in the expert auctions as March rolls around. So anything else about McCutcheon before we move on?
I think that's fine.
Yeah. Okay. So let's now move on to the next signing, which was actually the Mets filling their catcher void. They spent about a couple weeks, maybe even more than a couple weeks, trying to find a way to get JT Realmuto. But finally, they just sort of moved on, and I think it was actually a good move to just regroup. You know, keep your assets and just sign a very quality catcher in Wilson Ramos. 2-year deal with a club option for 2021. So, you know, this was clearly a priority for the Mets. And, you know, with Ramos, you know, staying healthy has been the challenge for him, you know, throughout his career. But when on the field, you know, he's been one of the game's most productive offensive catchers. Last season, 306 batting average, 15 homers, 70 RBIs in 111 games, stayed relatively healthy. And that was the encouraging thing for Ramos last season. So is Ramos a guy who you will be interested in drafting this year? He's always been sort of a favorite of mine.
I like Ramos. My thing about him is I noticed there's almost always a tax and people have kind of stretched on him. But I do like him, and I will say that if there's the belief that he's injury prone and a risk, and there's a discount, I'm going to be all over him. Rob Silver, our new colleague at Baseball Perspectives, I don't know if we even got to announce that on the last show. You know, very exciting news. We added Rob Silver, a Canadian political pundit, but also NFBC guru and champion. It's going to be great to have him adding his insights and to plug. You know, he kind of made this point. He talked about, I think Ramos is seventh or eighth going back to 2015, seventh or eighth in playing time. And it's really one injury in 2017 that knocked out most of that season. You're probably looking at 110 games from Ramos each year. And there was a time with catchers, you might be like, that's not a lot of games, that's not much. But how many catchers really play 140, 150 games? It just doesn't happen. So if you're getting Ramos and you're thinking 110 games, you're probably getting a top 10 catcher based on what he did last year. You know, he's hit 300 or over 300 to the last 3 years. He had LASIK, which has been documented ever since then. He's looked like a different hitter. I'm a fan of the move. I think he'll be solid. A nice thing for the Mets is if he is hurt, Travis d'Arnaud as a backup is not a bad thing to have. And, you know, as a starter, you can kind of be aggravated. But if you have to rely on d'Arnaud for 50 or 60 games, he should be okay. It should keep him fresh. Ramos is definitely a number one catcher in any format.
Yeah, the Mets are certainly in good shape. It didn't take long for them to now be in a strong position at the catcher position. So Ramos being drafted on average is the sixth catcher off the board in early NFBC drafts at 141 overall. So I think that's fairly appropriate. I think in the past he was sort of in that back end of the top 10. I always liked him as sort of a guy who could be a top five guy. But this year I think his value is about right. I don't think he's going to be a bargain, but at the same time, I think he's a pretty safe investment at that position.
Yeah, I mean, I look at that clump of catchers in an FBC, and it's like a top eight. And, you know, Yasmani Grandal, who the Mets were tied to, too, was eighth. And there's a drop in ADP from like 157 to 228 from Grandal to Yan Gomes. And, you know, we talked about Gomes on, I think, the last time out, Zach. And it really is a, it's really a, it's really a cliff there. Like, it feels to me that after those eight, if you don't get one of those, there's some uncertainty. Like, I certainly love Francisco Mejia, but, you know, is he going to play? Like, how's the time going to work out with Austin Hedges? Almost every catcher outside of that top eight has, and even Grandal, you know, depending where he lands, like, have some questions.
Yeah, you need one. You need at least one guy from that top seven, top eight group. I couldn't agree more with that. And you know, then with a second catcher, some owners like to draft a strong second catcher. But the second catcher, especially in a deep mixed league, is just sort of a crapshoot. But I definitely do like to secure one of those top eight, top ten guys. I was actually pretty lucky in Nick's auction tout this year. I drafted Wellington Castillo, which turned out not to be very good. But then my second catcher was Rondal. So my second catcher actually landed up outperforming my first catcher. And that's rare.
What round did you take Grandal in? You remember?
I bought Grandal for $5.
So oh, that's right. It was auction. Okay.
Yeah, this was Nick's auction.
That's a good price. Although that's right, people were really way too far in Grandal last year because you know, he lost playing time in the postseason. And yeah, I think in the beat the expert thing I did at Fantrax, I had Mike Zunino and I took them both like mid to late. I had Mike Zunino and Grandal, and Zunino didn't really work out because the average, but I got Grandal like toward the back end of the draft, and he was great.
Yeah, in OBP leagues, you know, he's very underrated. There was a lot of, like you said, Austin Barnes was projected as getting the majority of the at-bats heading into the season, so people were really scared of drafting Grandal, but I actually had him 2 years before. I think it might have been the year I won tout in 16. So I had him then, and I was like, you know, well, let's just try to go back to the well again with Grandal.
But by the way, we'll talk about this. But catcher is my stomach is hurting a little bit looking at catcher. it's rough.
Oh, it's ugly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's now. So now we're going to stay in New York, and we're going to now shift to the Yankees, who we sort of expected them to bring back J.A. Happ. They signed him to a 2-year, $34 million deal with a vesting option for 2021. Not much of a surprise, and especially since, you know, Happ, he proved that he could handle pitching in New York. He was great at Yankee Stadium, 4-0, 2.72 ERA, and 7 starts there last season. So he's a little on the old side at 36, but, you know, the thinking is that his pitching style will allow him to age well. So how would you value, you know, from a fantasy perspective, Happ this coming season? Is he someone who you'd be, say, happy with as your fourth or fifth starter in a mixed league? Or would you sooner take a chance on someone, a younger pitcher with maybe more upside?
I'm okay with Happ as my four. I wouldn't say I'd be happy with it, but if I got Happ as my four, I'd be like, okay, that's fine. My fifth is where I really want him. That's kind of where I think you should be looking at Happ. You know, my thing about Happ is I know he did well in Yankee Stadium. I know he did well there in the AL East. One of the reasons the Yankees got him in the first place is he pitched for Toronto. He seemed to be unflappable, you know, pitching against the Red Sox or Yankees. Didn't mean he was always great. It just meant that, you know, he'd have a bad game and he wouldn't let it get to him, or, you know, cough, Sonny Gray cough, you know, it wouldn't, like, you know, snowball. I just think pitching a full season at Yankee Stadium is going to be rough. I mean, unless you're Luis Severino, there's always going to be some, I don't want to say regression, but some struggles. So have somebody I look at as, you know, he's put up the last 3 years a 3.18, a 3.53, a 3.65. I kind of see him high threes, low fours. You know, unlike Roark, the strikeouts have trended the right way, and you know, Happ is pretty much fastball hardest. He's good. You know, it's just one of those things. It's so funny nowadays judging pitchers, because he's never cleared 200 innings in his career, but if you look at the volume by today's standards is fine.
Yeah, his numbers are actually surprisingly. I wasn't even aware of how consistent he's been until I really looked at those numbers. And you know, the nice thing is that, you know, he could pitch well in the AL East. He has experience there. He did have that bad start in the playoffs against the Red Sox, but you know, historically he has been good against the Red Sox. So yeah, I expect him to be just a very solid, you know, mid rotation guy for the Yankees. And like you said, if I draft him as my fifth starter, you know, in a deeper mixed league, I feel good about that.
Yeah. I think he's probably going to get drafted more like a four. And if you look at his ADP, I think he's even being taken as a three right now as a starter. Like he's 52 overall among pitchers, but that includes relievers.
Yeah, and maybe actually there is that Yankee tax that we sometimes refer to, and you know, maybe he is going to be, you know, you're not going to be able to get him for a decent price, whereas maybe in the past when he was with the Blue Jays, you know, you could get him for a little bit of a discount. So yeah, right. Have someone who will be, you know, he'll be on my radar, but I'm going to be careful not to really overpay for him. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
All right, so now let's move to Houston. The Astros signed the Astros have been, you know, sort of quieter than expected in the offseason, but they signed Michael Brantley for 2 years and $32 million. So it's a high average annual salary, but 2 years is a pretty good deal to get Michael Brantley. It's hard not to like the move from a fantasy perspective for Brantley. It's, you know, he's now going to be moving to the middle of a loaded Astros lineup, but the key for him last year was that, you know, he finally stayed healthy. He played 143 games, which was his most since 2014, which also happened to be his career best season. So, you know, maybe he's not going to ever duplicate what he did in 2014, but, you know, he's still a, you know, across the board type contributor that, you know, really is a fine fit on any fantasy roster.
Yeah, I'm a big Brantley fan. I traded for him in labor last year. I made a 3-for-1 for him, and I traded like Jason Kipnis and Albert Pujols before he got hurt, and I think there was like a third hitter who was like, oh, it was Carlos Gomez. So I kind of traded three old hitters for Brantley and took the risk he'd be healthy, and he was, and he was great. And I suspect the Astros are going to try to spot him and, you know, try not to run him out there for 162 games, but that could work. That could work really well if he rests once a week. You know, just looks like a player to me who's a solid all-around five-category player, kind of player who has more value in only, like where, you know, the volume, like, or the, you know, the fact he contributes something everywhere, and, you know, if he gets 130, 140 games has value, whereas in a mixed, it's not that he's bad, but more so in a standard mixed, because he's not necessarily, like, hitting 30 home runs or stealing 30 bases, there might be a little bit lacking. You might want to move him down a little bit. I'm not saying you don't want him, but you know, I think in a, like in a 12 team mix, I'd rather have someone who has like more of a ceiling or a carrying tool somewhere. So in a deep league, like in only though, I think I had Brantley like earning in the high 20s, and it's just because he does pretty much everything. And the other thing about Brantley that really impressed me last year, and I think others have pointed this out, he just doesn't strike out. His strikeout percentage was under 10%, which, you know, in the modern game, you know, given how hard pitchers throw, given, you know, like all the different pitches, you know, tough sliders, you know, changes, et cetera, he just does not strike out.
Yeah, his plate discipline skills fall into the category of elite, that's for sure. And, you know, that really gives you confidence that he's not going to really, you know, fall off a cliff dramatically in terms of production. So you know what you're going to get with Brantley. The only question is the health. So that's really the only issue that's going to maybe downgrade his price somewhat. So but if he does stay healthy, you know what you're going to get from him. And like you said, you know, maybe he's a better option in only league because he's going to, you know, per game, his production is going to be very valuable. And yet the total number of at-bats might not be as important. So now we're going to go to the Royals. And we actually talked about the Royals last time when we talked about Chris Owings. And we sort of had an idea that they were about to sign Billy Hamilton. You were talking about how the Royals are their goal this season is going to be to lead the league in stolen bases. So that apparently appears well on its way. So Hamilton signs a 1-year deal with the Royals. And how do you feel about him heading into this season compared to maybe how you felt about him heading into last season? Has that changed at all? Are you more the price is going to be dramatically different? So are you more open to drafting Hamilton this season compared to last year?
I'm probably less open. I feel like I got burned by Hamilton last year. And the biggest problem I have with Billy Hamilton, and it's the same problem that we had it, you know, with him last year. Last year, he batted ninth most of the year. At the very end, the Reds moved up the leadoff spot and you know, it seemed he'd run more. It appears the Royals are going to use the same approach. And, you know, it's a projected lineup. It's early, but if you look at the Royal setup, it looks like Whit Merrifield will lead off. Adalberto Mondesi will bat second. It looks like Hamilton will bat ninth. You know, could he, you know, could he steal from that position? Sure. And it's not the National League. He won't have a pitcher batting in front of him. That does help out. But I'm just kind of wary that I'm looking more at an empty 40 steals as opposed to an empty 60 steals. And to me, like in NL only, you still want to put a, AL only, you still want to put a price on him. Deeper mixed, I just feel, I kind of feel like others have felt, which is, yeah, I get it, 40 steals, it's still a special skill. But unless he falls in like kind of mid to late in a deeper mix, I don't think I want Billy Hamilton there.
Yeah, his NFBC ADP among outfielders right now is 49. So that's not like exactly a great discount. You'd think you'd get more of a discount for him. So, but the market is still valuing him, you know, fairly.
Well, what's the overall on him? Do you have that?
Oh, I don't have that. I don't have that. But it's 49 among outfielders.
No, I just want to I want to see what the overall is, because I'm kind of,
yeah.
You know, so yeah, 49 would make him in like a fourth outfielder in a. Yeah, he's 184 overall, which it's definitely a drop. But you know, it's funny. So two behind him is Byron Buxton, and I gotta say, I would rather. I don't know if I want either, because I got burned by both of them in the like way too many leagues I'm in. But I'd rather go Buxton and play that upside like in this like at this price. Than Hamilton, where I feel like, okay, all it is steals, whereas Buxton, it's steals and also like some power.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's going to be an overreaction to, you know, a jump on Hamilton because his price is going to be lower. But I think, you know, the price was way too high in the first place. And I think, you know, that 49, number 49 among outfield is still a little bit on the high side. And you know, that's just not the way I like to build my teams, you know, relying so heavily on one player to address a certain category. So I'm not going to be, Hamilton is not someone who's going to be on my radar, despite the, at least a moderate discount compared to last year.
Yeah, I agree. And I think to me, it's more that it's not even I was burned by Hamilton. It's just that I'm wary of him on the team he's on. Like, I think if I were going to go one dimensional and go discount, I'm probably going D. Gordon. He is going earlier, but D. Gordon's going like 116 compared to Hamilton. Like, Gordon, I have more faith in the bounce back and more faith in the baseball skills. You know, and being a good contact hitter, you know, bunting well, like having the skills to get on base versus Hamilton, where it's like, oh, I just watch him and it's frustrating because, you know, he doesn't really bunt well. You know, he doesn't really seem to have much bat control. He did walk more last year, but he also struck out a lot more as well.
And the key with Gordon is that he's someone who could help you in three categories as opposed to one. You know, so he's gonna give you the batting average and the run. So
right, that's the thing. You're right. Yeah. The upside of Gordon is three categories. The upside of Hamilton. Right. Especially on you know, batting ninth and on the Royals is, you know, maybe in runs, like, so it's like one and a half categories.
Yeah, I'll sooner address my steals by, you know, maybe a combination of two or three, you know, 20, 25 steal guys as opposed to Hamilton. So he's not someone I'll be looking at all. And, you know, that's it's something I'm not even going to really second guess one bit. So let's now the next I want to pair a couple of pitchers that were signed to free agent contracts that I'm going to pair because I actually saw a Twitter poll asking which contract you liked more from a team standpoint. And that was Lance Lynn, 3 years, $30 million, or Matt Harvey, 1 year, $11 million. So what do you, if you were the GM of a team, which contract, if any, would you be interested in giving someone?
Well, Lynn's the safer player. But my thing about one-year deals, and I've always said this, and I've said this even before baseball, you know, was like had $10 billion in revenues. There's almost no bad one-year deal. If the player doesn't work out, it's money. You're not committed. You know, my feeling about Lynn is if Lynn doesn't work out and he's mediocre or worse, you're kind of on the hook for 3 years. Harvey probably isn't going to work out. But in the, like, less than 5% chance that he does, it's kind of a fun get. Like there's that scintilla of upside with Matt Harvey. Like with Lance Lynn, you kind of look at him and you're like, eh, he is what he is. Like, he's kind of a mid-tier guy, you know, for fantasy, you know, bad park that drags him down. Harvey, like, showed flashes last year. I mean, I'm not saying to draft Matt Harvey is going to be great, but as a GM, I would take the risk on Harvey. Now, the other side of this is that the Angels are kind of weird because they signed Harvey and to steal our show's thunder. They signed Trevor Cahill. They need innings, and they're taking pitchers where they might not get those innings, and they don't really even have the farm to necessarily support the idea that they can live with like less than a full season from these pitchers.
Yeah, so I would say Harvey. I mean, I personally wouldn't be interested in either of these guys from a fantasy standpoint, but you know, like you said, Harvey, you could see his walk rate was still very good, so you could see him, you know, at least providing some value to AL only leagues. But then again, you know, this is his first foray into the American League, so we'll see how he makes those adjustments. Lynn pitched well in 2017, but was, you know, really terrible last year. He did pitch better following the trade to the Yankees, but you know, he's really not, obviously not a really great fit in Texas. He's more of a flyball pitcher, as far as I know.
Yeah, no, the one thing I'll say in Lynn's defense, and this is true of a number of pitchers, so, you know, he signed late. He didn't have much of a spring training, and that had to have an impact. Like, that definitely had to have an impact on him. So we really don't know. You know, he also came off of an injury. You know, 2017, he had a good ERA. His peripherals were poor, and he was coming off of, you know, major injury. The question more is that can he return to that 2014-2015 form where, you know, he was a solid pitcher? And that's the gamble that the Rangers are taking. And at that price, it's not really a bad gamble. It's just to, you know, to make that gamble for 3 years, it's kind of like, you know, we'll see. And Lance Lynn isn't young either. He's not old, but, you know, he's not like a young pitcher. You know, I guess I'm just intrigued by Harvey. I agree with you, Zach. I don't want either player for fantasy. But, you know, Harvey's just that pitcher I'm intrigued by because every once in a while you'd watch him. You know, so Matt Harvey, you know, if you had to guess and you've watched him pitch, people would probably guess he was throwing in the upper 80s last year. Matt Harvey's still hitting 94 in his fastball. It's just a straight pitch. He has to kind of figure out how to get some movement on the pitch. And if he can do that, he won't be the Matt Harvey of old, but I think he could be effective. You know, the problem that we've seen is, you know, some pitchers lose velocity or movement and they're done. Some pitchers do that, and because they're crafty or they're smart, they last for years and years. The question is, you know, can Matt Harvey figure out how to become that pitcher who is is good again and doesn't have that, like, you know, you said 97, 98 in the gum with movement.
Yeah, now home runs have been an issue for him over the last couple of years, and you gotta like. I mean, I'd say if I had to, you know, pick one for fantasy, I'd probably pick Lynn just because I'm a little more confident that he'll at least deliver, you know, decent maybe minor league numbers. But you know, Texas is just. I just wish he signed with any pretty much any other team besides Texas, especially hopefully in the National League. But I'm hopeful about Lynn, but the Texas fit just didn't seem to work out. But with Harvey, you know, his home ballpark's going to be Anaheim. It's a pretty pitcher friendly ballpark. Doesn't really give up a lot of home runs. But then again, Harvey, you know, was in Citi Field and he was giving up tons of home runs. So who knows? But I'd say I'd rather have Lynn, but I could also see an argument for, you know, Harvey with the better pitching environment and maybe the better upside.
Yeah, I agree, and I think again it's format dependent. Like in a standard boilerplate 12 team mix, you don't want either. But Harvey's the pitcher in that kind of league you might like take a stab on like as a streamer and then ride the hot streak. Whereas Lance Lynn, a standard boilerplate mix, you're probably just not even going to have.
So now sticking with the Angels. So after the Harvey signing, now the Angels go ahead and make a sign that I think is a pretty wise move. They signed Trevor Cahill to a 1 year and $9 million deal. So it's actually pretty funny that Cahill gets less than Harvey, considering that Cahill, you know, last year, 3.76 ERA, 1.19 WHIP, and a little under a strikeout per inning. So go figure why he gets, you know, less than Harvey with just the comparing the years that they had last season. So is Cahill, are you a believer in Cahill for 2019 as maybe at least an AL only guy or maybe even a
I've been intrigued by Cahill's stuff like over the last couple of years. Like he's made some improvements, like his arsenal has been stronger. My only thing with Cahill that I'm really thrown off by is, he just can't seem to like stay healthy. Like, you know, he threw 110 innings last year, you know, and it's his highest total since 2014, only 110 and two thirds. And then, you know, before, now to be fair, he was a reliever for a couple seasons, so that's part of it. But he just really, you know, he has like kind of minor injury after minor injury. They're not even like, you know, knocking him out. But I think if you're taking him, you're probably looking at 100 to 120 innings. And, you know, unlike someone like James Paxton, we talked about in the last show, it's not like you're looking at 110 to 120 elite innings. You're probably looking at 100, you know, good innings, like a 3.7 or, you know, like he did last year. So, yeah, I like Cahill in and only. I feel like somebody's going to probably push him to close to double digits, though, in like AL only or in labor. And I don't know if I want to go that high.
Yeah, it's certainly more of a quality over quantity issue with Cahill. Yeah, I wouldn't expect him to pitch any more than maybe, I'd say 140 innings maybe is his max. So we'll see how many innings he throws next season. But, you know, I was encouraged by the improvement in the hits per nine last year. He went from 9.8 hits per nine in 2017 to 7.4 last year. So he made a lot of improvement there. So, yeah, I think Cahill's someone, you said that maybe in an only he's going to cost double-digit dollars. I probably wouldn't spend that for him. But, you know, if I could get him for, you know, $7 or $8 in an AL only, you know, I'd be interested in that at that price.
Yeah, I think Cahill at that price is okay. I do think he'll go a little higher. I could see someone there's always one or two people who like Cahill. I can see him going 11 or 12 in labor AL, for example. That's a little bit high for me. I won't play in there. The one thing about Cahill that does intrigue me, and I was looking for this before when we were talking earlier, the pitch he increased, it's a slider. He abandoned that for years. Then in 2017, he started throwing it more. Last year, he threw it close to 20% of the time. That's why he was effective. That's what made people intrigued by him. But for some pitchers, it's a very stressful pitch. And for a pitcher like Cahill, who's frequently been hurt, that's what makes me a little wary.
All right. So now moving on, that was originally going to be the last guy we were going to talk about. But right before we began recording this podcast, word came that the Rockies have signed Daniel Murphy to a 2-year contract. And you gotta like this deal for Murphy. Murphy, you know, the injuries have been an issue. You're not sure how many games he's going to play, but the expectation is that he's going to play first base for the Rockies. So how encouraging is this news for you with respect to Daniel Murphy's fantasy value for 2019?
Well, it'll help if he's healthy. That's kind of always the question with Murphy. And, you know, we saw that last year. You know, last year he missed a big chunk of the season, and he started playing much later than we expected. I'm a little wary. I feel like Murphy's someone I'm not going to have, because he'll be 34 on April 1st. He's signed now through, you know, it's 2 years. So through age 35, there's no DH. There were some people linking him to the Yankees cause they thought, you know, they might use him at first and also use him at DH, you know, keep him off second. I don't know. I get the appeal of the park. I think it's cool. And, you know, we kind of saw with Murphy when, you know, that postseason with the Mets where, you know, it was the launch angle king. It was one of the first players to do that. I know the upside. The upside in Colorado is probably 320 with a bunch of home runs. I don't have a lot of faith in the health right now. That's my big concern.
Yeah, you would have liked to see him sign with an AL team. And, you know, you just don't know how many at-bats you're going to get out of him. So yeah, he's another guy who, you know, we actually owned him and you drafted him in the NL labor team that I managed last year. I spent about, well, he didn't make his season debut until maybe what, mid-May or early June or something. So he was basically on my DL for the first seven, 8 weeks of the season.
Yeah, it was June. You know, it's funny. So I look at the Steamer projection, and this is before the trade, obviously, 20 home runs and 616 plate appearances. If Daniel Murphy gets the 616 plate appearances, I could see him hitting 30 home runs and cores and hitting 300. I'm just not. And again, like, this is the whole injury prone thing. Murphy wasn't injury prone before last year. You know, if you go back over from 2012 to 2017, The fewest number of plate appearances he had was 538, which is pretty solid. It's just more the injury he had last year and the age and the fact that defense just seems to wear him down and he's never been good at defense to begin with. That's where I'm worried. That's where, you know, I often like to say I'm not a believer in injury prone. Giancarlo Stanton, people said he was injury prone. People say he was injury prone. If you look at Stanton the last two or three, I think 2 years, he's been healthy. And, you know, his injury prone was that he was like hanging over the plate and getting hit with pitches. Murphy, it's not that he's injury prone. It's that the injury he had last year combined with his age is a giant red flag.
Yeah, that's the issue with Murphy. It's really the age. And you know, I think with him, you know, everyone's going to be so, you know, gung-ho over him signing with the Rockies and what's this going to do for his fantasy value. He was a great sleeper. And, you know, then so I think he's an example of someone who I think we talked about it maybe with McCutchen, someone who, you know, the team is going to, the market is going to overreact to the news of him signing with the Rockies, you know, to the point where he might actually be a little overrated.
Well, that's the funny thing. His ADP before, you know, the move, because, you know, this is in drafts that, you know, took place up until today, was 157 overall. So 11th round pick, which seems okay. Yeah, I can see him going inside the top 100 easily.
Oh, definitely.
As a Rocky. And I just feel, to me, I feel like, yeah, that's probably most of the upside. And there's players who are younger and, like, more, you know, have more upside. I can rattle off like a lot of them, like Justin Turner, you know, he's older, but, you know, he's going just outside the top 100. Matt Olson's going just outside the top 100, even Travis Shaw. Murphy's probably going to go ahead of all of those players now that he's in Colorado. And I'd rather have any one of those players over Daniel Murphy.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Murphy's a guy that I'd be open to drafting. But, you know, at the same time, I'm probably going to, you know, go for maybe a younger, more exciting option. Even though Murphy, you know, he could give you a decent amount of profit relative to his price. You know, he's not someone that comes without some major risks. So anything else? So I think that will just about do it for Murphy.
I think that's it for Murphy. Yeah. I think we kind of covered it.
Austin Murphy, yeah. Okay, so now those are all the signings and trades that we wanted to talk about. Any other free agent predictions that you had, or any other things you wanted to discuss?
Free agent predictions, boy, that could be a whole other show.
I like to just take your temperature every time with your free agent.
Here's my prognosis. I think the Phillies are going to get Machado, and I feel, even though they haven't done it, we're going to see a repeat of A-Rod, and the White Sox are going to get Harper. It feels to me like the Yankees should get one of those players, but they're talking about the tax and they're talking about not going over. And it feels to me like they're not going to push for either one of them.
And then there was that Bob Nightingale tweet, I think it was like yesterday, that was like, the Yankees are enamored with Machado. And they think he would be a great fit. I'm not sure if that was like a joke or something, but that was a
little. Well, we were talking about this before the show, Zach, and you know, you're Jen and I are more on Twitter than, and you're not very much on Twitter. We kind of, there's like kind of a joke about Bob, how he's always wrong, and if he says something, yeah, like, you know, just it's the opposite's going to happen. So yeah, it doesn't feel to me like the Yankees are, you know, never count the Yankees out. Like, maybe they'll have a change of heart. They'll go all in. You know, I know Machado, like, I think there's some connection there in terms of it being his, I don't know, it was his boyhood team, or he liked A-Rod or whatever the connection was. But it just doesn't seem like they're going to, like, push in. And the Phillies are the team, I look at them, they feel like the team, you know, somebody was, I'm trying to think of what the analog was or the analogy was. Somebody was talking about a free agent where, was it last year or year before, and you know, the team came in and like offered so much more money and the player pretty much couldn't refuse. I feel like that's what's going to happen with Machado. It feels like the Phillies are going to be that team with the last offer, right, where they come in over like 30 or 40 or 50 million over on the life of the contract, you know, obviously not the AAV, and Machado is going to look at that and be like, yeah, I can't like turn that down. And the Phillies are up and coming team. Like, they, you know, they have Hoskins, they've got some, you know, good pitchers, they have Nola. it's really, you know, they've made some moves to improve this year. He could put himself in a situation where, you know, he's on a playoff team for a few years.
Yeah, it's sort of like an A-Rod 2000 situation with the Rangers, right? It was they just outbid everyone else, and he just couldn't say no to that contract.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, the A-Rod, that was my Harper analogy, because, you know, Harper could wind up with the White Sox if they give him the most money, and even though the White Sox have this great young core, it could be a situation where, at least for the first couple of years of the contract, the White Sox are competitive, and you kind of see Harper there, and you look at it, you feel weird, where you're like, well, you've got this great player on this team, and you know, they're winning 75 games.
And I wonder if the Yankees right now are kind of regretting that Stanton trade, because there's a lot of talk now that, oh, maybe Harper would be the better fit for the Yankees than Machado. So, you know, left-handed bat, Yankee Stadium, you know, was the Stanton trade something that, you know, really had to be done last year?
Do you listen to talk radio or no?
I do, yes.
So have you heard Francesa, like, going on and on about, like, how they should trade Stanton?
Yeah, I listen to him. I used to listen to him a lot, and now I listen to him sometimes.
I drive to my day job 2 days a week, so that's when and it's a long drive. So like Tuesday and Friday is when I listen to talk radio. As an aside, like people here in Philadelphia are talking about not what if the Eagles win the Super Bowl, but like when Nick Foles wins the Super Bowl, what will you do? But that's a whole other aside. But yeah, like Mike was going on about how they should trade Stanton, this, that, and the other. Yeah. I'm kind of like, well, I think they pretty much committed to Giancarlo Stanton. And really, his down year last year was still pretty damn good. Like, you know, he didn't do what he did with the Marlins, but he still was like an elite power hitter who had a solid year and just wasn't the ridiculous player that he was in 2017.
Yeah, and I think Mike actually always tends to overrate the Francesa. He always tends to overrate the kind of the lefty righty balance of the lineup.
Yeah. That's it. He has this whole weird thing where it's like, oh, the Yankees are missing that big lefty power hitter, and it's like, well, if you look at the park factors, like that's kind of a myth. Like, it's just the bandbox, and it doesn't really matter what side of the. It matters more for the pitchers, but like for the hitters, it's like it doesn't really matter what side you hit from. Like that place is just a bandbox, and the ball carries. And that's the thing about Stanton. Like he hit 38 home runs. He got on base 34% of the time, and that was a disappointing season. And Giancarlo next year could hit 45 to 50 home runs and hit 280, and it wouldn't surprise me. Like he's that kind of hitter. I suspect like if he stays at Yankee Stadium and he plays out that contract, which goes through like 2027, he's going to have probably 2 years similar to 2017 where he just hits a ton of home runs and goes off.
Well, Yankee fans would be very happy.
It won't be most of the contract. Like, he'll have more years like last year where he hits like 35 to 40 and you know, the average is good but not great. But I'm predicting have 1 or 2 years like 2017 where he just goes off and people are thrilled. And at one point he goes on a streak and it looks like he could, you know, break Bonds' record. I'm not saying he'll just do that thing where he flirts a little bit.
Yeah, and especially playing half his games at Yankee Stadium, you think that he has at least a chance to, you know, put together one more of those years. So Yankee fans will certainly be happy if that happens. And I think that will just about do it for this edition of Flags Fly Forever. The next time you'll hear us, the year will be 2019. And we will be getting started with our annual position preview series. But until then, enjoy the rest of 2018, and we'll see you next year. We'll be right back.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to episode 179 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball perspectives podcast. Once again, I'm Mike Gianella, along with your co-host, Zach Steinhorn, and behind the glass, Jeb Mac Ramos. Don't forget to rate and review us on all the wonderful places you can do that. iTunes, Stitcher, etc., etc. And also, you know, Zach alluded to before, 2019 is going to be when we ramp up our coverage. We'll have about 20 articles a week on fantasy, believe it or not, starting with Catcher Week, which starts Monday, January 7th. So we're jazzed. We're looking forward to it. Happy holidays, whatever you guys and everybody celebrates, and happy new year.
Thanks for listening.